Hey, this is Jeremy Roenick, and guess what? You guys are listening to the Jim Bob Show.
Hey, this is Wayne Larrabee, and you're listening to Roar on WGN.
Hey, this is Jim McMahon, and you're listening to the Jim Bob Show.
I had to pop a beer for this one.
Attaboy.
Yeah.
Hey, this is Brian Urlacher, and you're listening to the Jim Bob Show.
That's awesome. Oh,
and
that's
then,
it.
How about one? This is Brian Urlacher. I'm not a bitch.
No.
That's about, love that one.
Half the coaches in the league. The Mondays were the worst. And that's when you really got tested, when you came off a tough loss. You got into the office on Monday. You found out two more players were hurt. You didn't realize. The sky's always falling in the NFL on Mondays.
Yeah, they're 40-1, which is shorter than I thought. You know, it,
why aren't they 100-1?
Yeah,
you know?
I know.
720 WGN High atop Chicago in the Skyline studio. And on great stations all around the country, to the Jim Bob Show game day edition. And Jim Bob on the line. We've got a world champion, a guy who's played in six Super Bowls, championship coach, best-selling author. It is the one and only
Don Beebe. Here we go. And I tell you what, is that, like I was saying off the air, is that I had about 10 guys go, oh man, loved him. You know, they loved you more, I think, when you were a Packer than when you were a Bill. But, we were talking about one of the greatest plays in Super Bowl history, which people don't understand the significance of that play. Not only did you stop Leon Lett from scoring a touchdown, it wasn't like it was a go-ahead touchdown. It was a touchdown that kept the record for most scores in a Super Bowl from happening. that was the hustle play, the best hustle play in Super Bowl history. I'll tell you what, is that you should be commended for it. It's just all about heart, all about gut and will. It really is one of the greatest plays, I think, in Super Bowl history.
Well, I appreciate that, guys. I certainly didn't know that at the time, because you watched my reaction. I was pretty upset. We're still getting our tails whooped after it happened, right? It really started meaning something, to be honest with you. When I got into the locker room and the owner, Ralph Wilson, literally made a beeline right to my locker. I mean, when he walks in, everybody kind of knows the owner just walks in, right?
Yeah.
And he bypassed everybody, came right to me. And he said something I'll never forget. He goes, you know what, Don? He said, you showed me exactly what the Buffalo Bills are all about. And I just want to say thank you. And I was like, wow, it meant a lot to him.
Yeah.
So then I got down to the press, and it was incredible. And then the boxes, I'm telling you, I got hundreds and hundreds of fan mail letters every day for weeks and weeks. And you know what's funny is here we are, I don't even know, what is it, 27, 28 years later, maybe 30 now, and I still get fan mail every day.
And you should. I will tell you, it's an inspirational play. It really talks about we never quit, we never give up, which is your story. Yeah. I mean, that is your story. And we got such a big list to talk to you about, because you really have. You've done so much other than, you know, just simply playing in the NFL, which that in itself, you know, that's a one percenter deal. I mean, but your story of where you're coming from Chadron State, which we were talking about that. They go, where do you go to school? I go, I do know that. He went to Chadron State. And they go, Chadron State. I go, I bet you don't know who all went there. And I was naming. I go, Danny Woodhead went there too. And then I go, yeah. Garrett Gilkey, Joe Pulaski. And they go, how do you know this? I go, oh, I looked it up. You got to know your guy. But anyhow, one of the things too is I find interesting. So I was talking about Xavier Worthy. And we were talking about the draft breakdown, and one of our companies, El Bendito Yankee, has a suite in Kansas City. We got one in Green Bay. We got one in Minnesota. And I was telling people, so obviously with all of the football that we see and the games that we go to, and we watch a lot of film, we talk about on the show, but I was talking about Worthy and what he's going to do as far as the defense. He's going to lengthen that field, stretch it. And people don't realize this, but in your era, when you were coming out, you were the fastest receiver in the receiving corps to run in the combine that year that you came out and got drafted in the third round. And I was going to ask you, I said, you know, you were 4.4, but, you know, on some of the watches, you're below 4.4. What do you think about these guys like Xavier that run the 4.2 and some guys have them at the 1.9, 1.8? I mean, boy, you are fast, but this is blazing.
Yeah. Well, actually, I'm going to set the record straight for you, because I really didn't know this until 3 years after my career was over. You know, because remember back in 89 when I went to the combine, press wasn't allowed in the dome. Nobody was allowed in that dome except personnel, NFL personnel. And so nobody knew what I ran. They posted that night 4.39, and that's what everybody thought. And so 3 years after, I'm training guys through House of Speed to go to the combine, and I can't remember the player right now, but I was sitting in the box with Bill Polian, who obviously started Bledsoe mm-hmm. way back in, I want to say, late 70s, early 80s sometime. And then eventually it turned into what is now the Combine. And when I went there, he told me, and he was sitting right next to Tony Dungy. I'll never forget. He said, "Hey, Biebs," he goes, "you know you still hold the Combine record." And this was 2003 or 4. And I looked at him and I said, "What are you talking about?" He goes, "Yeah, you and Dion ran a 4.25 that year." And I was like, wow, I never knew that. So actually that record stood for 17 years. We broke it, me and Dion, in 89, and it stood until, I want to say, 06 or 07 when Chris Johnson ran at 4.23.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
I would have never said that if it wasn't true, but I want you guys to know, and this is the inside story. I have an agent. I didn't even know what an agent was.
Yeah.
I was so naive from Shadron. And I go into this place, and I had no running shoes. All I had was my old ASIC fishing shoes from high school.
Oh, my God.
And my right sole, this is a true story, my right sole was unglued halfway, so when I ran, it flopped. So I ran a 4.25 in a flopping fishing shoe, and that's the honest truth.
Well, I will tell you, Polian is a good buddy. I talk to Bill a lot. He's a great dude, and he was he was on as a consultant for us when we were doing some stuff with the NFL. And at the time they were the Washington Redskins. And so Bill's a trusted confidant. And if Bill said it, I believe it. And let me tell you something.
Yeah.
You know, if you watch the Leon Lett play in the Super Bowl, I believe you ran a 4.25 for sure. And I'm telling you what is it, but. And that's it. That kind of segues into something I wanted to talk to you about. Cause you know, when you come into the league, you know, in 89 and you go to the Bills and they had, you know, Andre Reed. I don't know if you know this, but when you came in that first year you're there, Andre Reed production went up almost 400 some yards. And I was wondering, it wasn't like they targeted you a ton, but you know, obviously you got on the field and you scored, you had yards and so forth, but I was just wondering if the defenses reacted to that like they're going to have to react like Xavier Worthy, because it opens up the field. And Andre Reed, that first year you're there, I mean, he has to thank you a little bit for his that contract year he got, too. But I was noticing when you came in, Reed's stats went up that first year, you know, went up 400 yards in production because it opened things up for him. And you guys must have caused a little bit of issue in regards to defense.
Yeah, I was one of those, the key to the whole thing, the machine. Everybody has their thing that they do for the offense that we had. And it takes 11 guys, as you well know. And it's funny that you say that because it just kind of registered to me. That year, I didn't have a lot of production. I want to say it was like 20 catches, somewhere around
there. Yeah, he had 17 catches, 317 yards, a couple touchdowns.
Yeah, you know better than me.
Yeah, no.
To your point, this is what happened. My first pass that ever went my way was in the Astrodome, the third game, because I didn't play the first and second game. And then we started going to a little bit more third down stuff with the third receiver, and that was me. So the first pass that went my way was a 63-yard bomb touchdown against Chris Dishman. And then a couple weeks later, I had another 63-yard bomb at Rich Stadium against the Dolphins. So, yeah, I think it might have been a lot of point or catches, but it was big plays that defenses had to be aware of. And I agree. And then the next year, we bring in James Lofton.
Right.
And now you got James and me on both sides with Andre in the middle and Thurman. And it became the offense that it did.
Well, you guys had a trio there because I always tell the story about one time when I was at the Chiefs and I got the defense got screwed up and I'm out on Lofton. And, you know, the rumor was Lofton could run and I didn't want to find out firsthand. So I, you know, we start up and, you know, I was sitting up at 7-1 and then they go, "Jim Bob, it's Lofton." And then the next thing you know, I'm like 15-1. and so Lofton takes three steps, you know, gets a catch and we force him out of bounds. But hey, he didn't score any 65 yard touchdown. But the fact of it is that when you guys brought in Lofton, and it was kind of interesting. I was looking at when you came in because you had that speed and you had that reputation of the fastest time ever in the combine. It was, you know, at the receiver corps. And I'm like going, man, what did that do to that offense? And then I looked at it and I saw that Andre, I mean, his production went up, you know, 400 plus yards over that. And I go, well, that had something to do with it because they had to respect, because that, you know, even back then we didn't have as much media as we do today. But this Xavier Worthy deal is a similar situation. Now I look at it, is that he comes in way more publicity than you would have got back in 1989. And I just think the defenses are going to recognize. And I looked for a fact that it darn sure helped Andre Reed's career. I know that when you came on board.
Yeah. And I'll go back to, let's go back to Bill Polian too. And he always used to say, don't ever fall in love with a guy in shorts. You know, so yeah, he might be able to run fast, but is he a football player? Well, that's yet to be seen, really. In college to the pros, as you know, is a big difference. You know, so from the pressure, the physical demands on you, and all those things, can he run with those pads and then still perform? So, you know, that's yet to be seen. I believe that he can.
Yeah,
funny. Sometimes I think it'd be overrated.
It's funny you bring that up. Is that because I was reading one of the stories about you and Dana and I were talking about Vince Papale, and I said, well, we got to bring that up with Don because, you know, he met him and then he met, thing of Ron Dunham or whatever about when we were going to do the movie on you. And I go, you know, because Vince, you know, he switched out of his pads. He did everything he could to drop that weight to run. But Bill's point, you know, hey, don't fall in love with a guy in shorts. It's what a great line that is, though, too, man. It's so perfect.
On the parallels there, you look at whether it's the Chiefs and just how they, I think them being able to win another Super Bowl this last year without that deep threat just shows, I think, the capabilities, the versatility of the team. And now they've got a guy that's going to be able to stretch the field. You were on teams that had to continue to win. The Chiefs are going to go for three Super Bowls. And with the Bills, you made it to four. Talk a little bit about that and sort of the parallels, just how hard it is not only to get to those games, but to kind of keep it going, right, and have that continued success when everyone's gunning for you.
Yeah, when I hear that question posed to me, I always think of one man, and there's a lot to fit in this category. His name was Charlie Joyner. He coached me 4 years in Buffalo. Obviously, he played for the Chargers, played 18 years, and never sniffed the Super Bowl. And it's just so hard to get there. And the guys that play at any level, I mean, high school to the state championship, collegiately to the national championship, and then to the Super Bowl, it's hard. It's not always the most talented team.
Yeah.
You need breaks. And going back to the Chiefs, I think this should be stated. The reason they're so good, no matter who is, you know, running or throwing or whatever, Andy Reid and when I was in Green Bay, he was the tight end coach now under Holmgren. Andy Reid, I could argue, is the greatest play calling, play design, offensive guy in NFL history. That's how good that guy is.
Yeah, I would tend to agree with that. I tell you, is that Andy's done such a great job and put things together. I was a little bit shocked, and we're staying on this, and we're going to move off it, but the Chiefs gave a pretty nice extension to Travis, and you know, he's getting a little long in the tooth. I mean, but they, you know, they were talking about it. I go, hey, look, he's the first guy out there, and he still acts like he's, you know, 27-year-old kid out on the field. But you know, they're keeping that nucleus of that team together. And then with what they did in the draft, they had a pretty good grade on the draft. And I don't know if you follow the Bills and who they're drafting and all the players and so forth today. You follow the Packers?
Buffalo and Green Bay to some. I really like what I thought the Packers had a better draft, even though I think, you know, this Keon Coleman guy that they got in for the Bills from Florida State is, I really like this guy.
Yeah.
I mean, I think this guy could be special, and he's going to have to be. I mean, they got really nobody after Diggs left. So it's going to be interesting to see how he develops. But boys, he got a personality. Have you heard this kid?
Yeah, Dave, I heard him the other day. He was so fun. I mean, they had a special on him the other day. I mean, he's like a comedian. I mean, he's like, he really is. I think he is. I agree with you. I saw some film on the kid and you know, I liked the way he did that. I was curious, you know, when we talk about your career, you had a great career and like everything else, you know, we've had McMahon on, we've had Urlacher on, we've had a lot of, you know, we had Fincic and Plank on, a lot of the guys that played back in the 80s era, in the early 90s, and we didn't have the concussion protocol that they have today. But I can remember, you know, Dale Lindsey was our defensive coordinator, and we had some guys getting hurt, and I was in there, and I hit Wade Wilson, and it was one of those ESPN deals. It was da 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 da. I hit him. I came up, and he tried to, you know, he's going to try to run, and Wade was a big dude. He's like 6'4", and probably played at 246, and he tried to jump me, and his knee hit the crown of my head, and I'm like knocked out, and I'm going to the sidelines, and Dale Lindsey goes, "What are you doing?" I go, "Man, I got to clear my head." He goes, "We got nobody else. Get your ass back out there." And so I had to go out. And the next play, Wade Wilson throws me an interception, and I run it back like 85 yards. Don't remember the play to this day. Only reason I know about it, because, you know, as we do films on, we'd come in on Monday or Tuesday and do films, depending if we got an extra day off. And I see the play, and I go, "Oh, cool." And then I go, "Well, that was me." And so, I mean, you had seven really bad concussions. And we're talking about, you know, we talked to McMahon, we talked to Urlacher. We talked about, we're going to talk to you a little bit later about the Gridiron Greats. But, you know, I know that you went through a lot of protocol in regards to concussion element, and you were a really strong believer in stuff behind it. There's a deal where you said, hey, I think I had like 7 hours of MRIs. Tell us about, you know, the whole process.
Well, first, it was just, like you said, a different era. And, you know, and a lot of information out that they actually knew what was happening, that which that's the most disturbing. Now, how true is that? I don't know. And they can fight that on the courts. But I don't want to say my favorite concussion story, but true story was against the Lions in Lambeau in the 96 season. Now, Brooksy had already gone down, Robert Brooks with the ACL, and Freeman had broke his arm. So I had become the number one receiver at that time because those two guys were down. And I caught a pass, a slant, over the middle at about the 1 yard line and got smoked and hit my jaw right in the face. And it kind of knocked me. I knocked the wind out of me. I was on all fours. Of course, Favre comes up and he goes, what the? Get up. Let's go, you know.
Yeah, right.
Typical Brett.
Yeah, right.
And I get over. They walked me over to the sideline and they cleared me to play. So I came back in the second quarter and kept playing. And then right before halftime, Benny Blades, a safety, hit me. He was a safety on a cover two, and I was in the void area, and I was going up to get the ball, and he came in like a battering ram, and we hit head-to-head in midair going for the ball, and we went down, both of us, on our stomachs, and we were both knocked out cold. I was out for over 2 minutes.
Wow.
They put smelling salts up to my nose, didn't even move me. They said I was snoring. Next thing I know, I'm in the locker room, and I'm telling them, I'm good, guys, I'm fine. And so I get back out there, and they said I was done. They hid my helmet. I talked to, I won't name the name because I don't want to get him in trouble, one of the equipment guys. And I said, hey, I said, where's my helmet? He says, oh, Beach, I can't tell you that. I said, $50. Where's it at?
What a cheapskate.
Okay, $100, whatever it was. So I'm walking down because the direction he pointed, and I found it underneath the tarp where the snapshots came down for Favre underneath the tent, right? So I pick up, there's my helmet. I put it on. We're literally right in the middle of a series, and this is the honest truth. Now, that was back when we huddled in Green Bay. Derek Mays, the rookie, was in there. They have a run play. I run on the field, tell Derek to get off, scored on that play, a 65-yard touchdown.
Wow.
Yeah. And then never came back out.
Yeah, I remember that. And that was like, I go, that is, I mean, today, I mean, first of all, you wouldn't be allowed to do any of that stuff. But no. I mean, you know, when we do these, and we talk to Urlacher, and he's really gets behind the Gridiron Great stuff. And, you know, not so much, I mean, the guys in the 80s, I mean, we talk about Dave Duerson and Junior Seau and those guys. I mean, and even the tight end at Patriots, Hernandez, Aaron, and, you know, he had, you know, severe CTE issues and so forth. I mean, and, you know, his behavior was accordingly. I mean, but think about the guys back in that era of the 70s and even, you know, some of the guys that are still around from those early Packer dynasties, you know, I mean, golly, and you've seen it firsthand. I mean, we've seen some of the guys that we play with that, you know, some of them didn't make to 50, some of them didn't make it to 60, you know, and the type of punishment that was delivered and so forth. But I think that what they're doing with that Gridiron Greats is trying to get something back for those guys, but it really is. I think it requires more attention from all the players.
Yeah, it really does. I think you got to be involved in it. I know that they made a push to this. They really need to go to the youth programs and teach these people how to tackle. And if coaches are not coaching that, they should not be coaching at the youth leagues.
Yeah.
Because what happens, and you know this is very well, what happens on Sunday trickles to Saturday, trickles to Friday night, and then all the way to your youth leagues. And when they see guys just using their head as a battering ram, flying in there trying to blow a guy up, well, that's what Johnny's going to do in the backyard.
Right.
You know, and they start to learn these techniques, and they need to be corrected at a very young age how to tackle.
From the, you know, inspiration side, the educational side, you know, not everybody who is a great football player at the highest level is a great teacher or even wants to be. And that is something that's been very important to you, not only to teach them how to be great players and how to have great teams. You won a few state championships. You've got a great record on the college side. Talk a little bit about that, though, and from changing the game, not only just the scoreboard and what's up there, but just the way that it's played to kind of, you know, have the game continue, have people be healthier, you know, all those things built into that mindset.
Well, they're always trying to, I mean, make the game better, which I'm fine with. The only thing I would say is just whoever making these rules I would prefer that they would be people that have played the game, whatever game they're talking about.
Right.
Not somebody that's never played it, because how would they know and experience it and stuff that they try to implement, I think, are crazy. But it definitely can always get better. We know that. Even as an athlete, I always thought I could get better. I'm sure Jim was the same way. So, but I really think that when we got to hold these people accountable at younger levels, teaching the character, okay, because I see some of these 7-on-7 leagues, and it's an embarrassment what they teach these kids. An embarrassment. I mean, it's like these guys are out just, I don't even want to say what I want to say.
Well, I know what you're going to say. It is. Yeah. Here's the deal. Is that this 7-on-7 league stuff, I mean, it really is. I mean, it's stuff that I could never condone. And I want to kind of segue back here for a second. So one of the things is that, you know, when you started your coaching career and you're coaching, you know, with your brother, and then, you know, you've got your brother and your other brother's the athletic director, and you're volunteering and so forth. And so you don't know this, but when we played against you, my kids went to Central Catholic, and so we're playing you guys in the championship in 2008, and I so much wanted to come over and say hi and everything, and my friends were going, you can't go over and talk to him. He's getting ready to play the state championship. I go, you can't do that. And I go, I followed your coaching career because, you know, of that and what you were doing in Aurora, and you're, you know, here in the state and so forth. But, you know, you've had a great coaching career at that level in high school, and then you moved to Division III with Aurora University. You've had opportunities. People wanted you to move on. And I love the story so much about you. And there's some photos that we were looking at, and you're just so, so proud, and you're such a spiritual guy and so forth. I am curious as to why didn't you leave? Because, you know, there was a level where you could have taken that coaching side, and it could have, who knows, your coaching career could have been as great as your playing career. And I'm not saying because you're coaching at this level, but you had your opportunities to go to Division I or beyond.
Yeah. Well, first of all, I'm very impressed with the knowledge that you know. You really do your homework.
Well,
that's pretty good.
Hey, you're a great study buddy. Let me tell you something. Your books, your spiritual playbook for athletes, and your six rings from nowhere. And we're going to talk about that a little bit as well. But, you know, I read about your high school, and when we were playing in the state championship back in 2008, is that I get intrigued by some of the guys. Like, you know, a good story. So, you know, Chuck Cecil, I'm sitting on the sidelines with Mark Murphy, and Murph and I worked out together the year before, and we're getting ready for the season, and Chuck, like we're talking about, hits this kid that we drafted from Stanford and knocks his helmet off, and it goes up in the air, and for a second you think the kid's decapitated, okay? And so I'm sitting there with Murph, and Chuck's playing second team and just smokes this kid, and the kid's out, never comes back and plays again, and I'm holding my helmet, we're on our knees, and I look at Murph, I go, what's the name of that truck driving school we were talking about? I mean, but you had those kind of guys back in our era. You had him, you had Ronnie Lott. I mean, you had guys that would, and you talked about some of them. I mean, they would just smoke you, and you know, they couldn't play. I mean, Chuck would have been suspended for the year on some of his hits. They wouldn't have let him play on some of the things. But I mean, I know you're teaching the kids. I know you guys, but how was it coaching with your brother and your family? Was it just great?
Well, I'm going to answer the one question you asked about coaching at a higher level first, and I'm going to get spiritual here because you're right. I mean, everything that I am is a man of faith first before anything else. And I knew that I was called to coach at Aurora Christian High School, that at that time in 04, keep in mind, they had no weight room. They had no football field. And they had 17 kids in the whole program, freshmen through senior years. And I remember standing in front of them the very first meeting and 17 kids. And I told them, I said, guys, we're going to win the state title. It's going to happen here. Okay. The first thing is you got to believe it. And the second thing is we're going to work harder than anybody else. And so we went on that path. And then right after the first year, I had Marv Levy, Coach Levy came in and spoke at the first playoff game in ACS history in the dilapidated locker room over at Moose Heart. Okay. Because we didn't have a home field. And there's Coach giving that, you know, where would you rather be right here than right now, to these kids?
Oh, man.
You know? And he asked me, and the season was over, and then the next year came, and it was December of 2005, and he called me, and he said, hey, Don, listen, and I'll never forget this call. It's 9:30 at night. He says, Don, I just want you to know I'm going to announce tomorrow that I'm going to become the Buffalo Bills general manager tomorrow. And in my mind, I'm thinking, well, golly, that's great, Coach, awesome. And I'm thinking, why is he calling me? This is kind of crazy. And he goes, I want you to go coach with me. And I said, man, coach, first, I'm honored that you would ask.
But I
got to tell you, coach, I said, and this was just after really 2 years of coaching the Roar, you know, Christian High School. And I said, God called me to ACS. I can't leave that. And then I always go to scripture, okay? Because everybody knows the scripture, Philippians 4:13. I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me. Well, I think in the world of sports that scripture is really taken out of context. Because really in Philippians 4:11 and 12, where Paul talks about, and I'm going to give you what I think the definition of success is in life, is exactly what Paul's talking about in Philippians 4:12 when he says, I know what it means to have everything and I know what it means to have nothing. And he says, and everything in between. And the one thing that I'm constant with is I'm content with where God has me. And when I read that scripture and study that scripture, why would I want to leave where I know where God has me and wants me? And in being enticed by, yeah, going to coach in the NFL and making that money and all that stuff and maybe going to Super Bowl as a coach. I mean, that'd have been great, guys, but it wasn't where God wanted me. And I can honestly say after 18 years later, I got absolutely no regrets. I made the right decision. And I've loved my job and I love what I'm doing.
I love it, buddy. I tell you what, you are now where you are supposed to be. And and here's the deal. And your stories are great. And I love reading about you and when you're Aurora Christian and Aurora University. And I like what you're doing. And it's just good stuff. And you're doing such good work and you're doing great work. You're doing life work. You're doing God's work. You really are. You're wonderful testimonial to life and living that example. And what I wanted to know though is that even as faith-based as we are, did you and your brother get into it? You go, why are we running that defense?
You know, it's funny. That's really a great question. So I wanted to, when we go over to coaching, first of all, we're all volunteer coaches, so nobody's being paid.
Right.
And I told my brother when he took the job, and he had never coached before.
David had never coached.
No, this was his first time he ever coached. And I just wanted to coach with him and have a family thing, right? And then my brother Dan, the athletic director, came in, I want to say 3-4 years after that. But when I hired Dave and asked him to coach, he was the first call I made when I knew I was going to wanted that job. And he says, I'm in. That's exactly what he said. I'm in. And I told him then, I said, Dave, look, I want you to come in and enjoy coaching. I'm not going to micromanage. We're going to sit down and kind of talk things through first initially, and then it's your baby. You do what you want. I'll coach the offense. You coach the defense. I never one time, and this is the honest truth, I've never one time told him, I stop doing that. I need to do this or whatever it is, even all the way through the championship games and stuff of that nature, because then I would have it would have stolen the joy for him, because how does he learn? Well, you learn by your mistakes.
Yeah.
And he became a great coach.
Talk about kind of being able to teach people, learn along with them. It's one thing, the impact you can have on a team in front of them, talking to them, teaching them right there. On the author side, being able to take that leverage, that communication, extend that reach on whether it's the mission or the messages. Talk a little bit about the books. You know, not everybody that plays can coach. Not everybody that plays and coach can write books. Right. To be able to do that. Did someone come and say, hey, Don, you got a book in you? Or were you like, this is another way that I can spread the word?
Yeah. Well, both, actually. So, I mean, I'm going to go all the way back to 89 when I was drafted. First of all, it was a crazy story. I should have never played in the NFL. It was just God's calling in my life and he just opened doors. And so when I got drafted as the first pick of the Buffalo Bills, which was absolutely insane, that happened. People, you know, close to me, family members and close friends were saying, man, you should write a book, man. This is a movie, you know, and I'm like, I'm just not a movie guy. I'm not a book guy. And so the years went on. We went to 4 Super Bowls. Then I went to Green Bay, and we had a Super Bowl. And now in an iconic place like Green Bay, prominent people like the governor. I spoke at the governor's breakfast in Milwaukee in the late 90s. And he came up to me afterwards and says, man, you need to make this a movie. And then other prominent people were saying, this is a movie. This is a movie. And I'm like, well, then finally a book came out on the story, More Than a Ring. And then that morphed into Six Rings from Nowhere. And that's the book that's out now, Six Rings from Nowhere. I did sign a deal to do a movie some years ago, but it never got funded. And I had a 3-year contract with them. But through that whole process, I've met other people. And just recently, just like I want to say 5-6 weeks ago, I agreed to terms with Salty Earth Productions out of state of Wisconsin. And Steve and Beth Sambo own the company. And this thing's going to come to fruition now because they're going to get funded. They've done several movies already, and this thing's going to come to the screen. But going back to what you just said, Dane, really, from my very first talk with these people, I said, if this is about me and spiritualizing or Hollywoodizing this movie and making it what it wasn't really, and just to make it a movie to make money or no, I said, guys, I have no interest in that. However, if this has everything to do with spreading the gospel and just telling what God did for me, I said, I'm all in. I said, on one condition, I want the final say what is said in this movie. And they agreed, and they loved it. I said, I'm not a cinematographer. I'm not a producer. I said, that's out of my realm. I said, however, what is said and done in this movie, I want final say. I might be the only person that's ever had those on a, I don't know. Maybe
you and others. Kevin Costner.
Yeah, okay. Well, that's a whole lot more popular.
You know, you talk about in an article you were talking about when you met, you know, Vince Papale and the comparison to Rudy. Yeah. I think your story is really great. You know, I think about, you know, when you're sitting in front of your teams, whether it was your high school teams or now your college teams or whether you're speaking engagements and so forth, you've got such great stories. And you know, you played with two of the best. Is that I got a funny story for you. So, you know, Jim Kelly is playing in the USFL when I was playing there, and I was in San Antonio, and Jimmy's over at Houston. And we're at a party one time at Jimmy's house. And I look a little bit like Danny, his brother. And this girl, Monica, she was a good looking girl. She comes up to me and she goes, Danny, why don't you ever ask me out? and so my friend goes, no, cut it off. And I see Danny across the way, and Danny could be really ornery, but we every year, Jimmy used to have a party down there with the Houston Gamblers, and we'd go over to it. I had a lot of guys from Pittsburgh area and Penn State area, and he's a character. And then you play with him for all those years, and then you go with Favre, who's like, they're almost like twins personality, you know? And you talk about, everybody talks about Favre, how hard he threw and so forth. Yeah. Nobody ever, none of the receivers, I remember talking to them all about with Jimmy Kelly when they're at Houston, and really complained about Jimmy's ball. But Favre threw so hard, and I was reading about you would get in front of the ball launcher, and you would catch, you were like 6 or 7 inches away, and they would come out of that thing at 65 mile an hour. And you got a great story about that. But of all the guys you played with, I mean, and so forth, I mean, did anybody throw the ball harder than Favre?
No. Favre, like you said, it's like standing in the box in Nolan Ryan's pitching, and you got to hit it. You just have to get used to that timing. So you're right. Yeah, I had a jug machine already when I was in Buffalo. But when I knew that I was going to be catching balls from Brett, and I went to one mini camp in, when was it? May of 96, I think it was. And I'm like, holy smokes. So I started doing drills over that offseason, catching balls 65 miles an hour, 6 inches away from that ball and shooting it out. And what it did is it strengthened my hands, but it broke down all the nerves in my fingers, because when he would blow a blood vessel or something, man, it stung.
Oh yeah,
that ball, it hurt.
You got some crooked fingers. Yeah, you got some Favre-ism fingers. I know that. Yeah. Hey, I got a question. So when you left Buffalo, what was the mechanism and the events that took you to Carolina, which I didn't understand that one year there? What happened?
Yeah, well, you know, and this is one of the things that I wrote in the new book that I just wrote called Never Give Up. The book is Never Give Up. And one of the stories I talk about was the Carolina story. It was the worst year in my career for football by far. I mean, it was just an awful experience, but yet it was a great growing experience because I always believe you grow through adversity. And that was a very adverse time. I didn't fit in. I went down because I think Polian brought me and Frank Reich and Pete Metzler's down there from the Buffalo team. And I didn't fit in with the offensive coordinator and the wide receiver coach. So I think there was a clash there. Finding out later.
Uh-huh.
And it just felt like I was, you know, it was my seventh year and I felt like a rookie. And I just, you know, it was just one of those experiences that wasn't fun. And it wasn't fun for Frank either, but spiritually I grew a ton.
When you left, I mean, was it a contract deal? I mean, what was going on in Buffalo at the time?
Oh, going back to Buffalo, I wanted to stay in Buffalo. And this is why, one of the reasons I really enjoyed being coached by Coach Levy. I think he's one of the greatest coaches of all time. Highest character coach I've ever been around, because he brought me in face to face. It wasn't like he texted me or he saw it on, you know, social media or whatever. Of course, we didn't have that then, but or on TV that Don Beebe was not going to be resigned. Coach brought me in, and he didn't have to do this. And he does this with all the guys. He sits you down. And he says, "Hey, Don, listen, I just want you to know we're going to go into a younger generation." You know, this was after four Super Bowls, and then the 94 season, we didn't go to the Super Bowl, obviously, and didn't have a great year as a team. And they thought they were going to start going into a younger, you know, situation. And I said, Coach, thanks for, I appreciate it. I loved it. I wanted to stay there. I didn't want to leave, but they wanted to move in a direction. I got great respect for that. And then I went to Carolina because Frank was there, and I thought it would have been a great thing. And they told me I was going to be this and that, and it just blew up everything. And it was just a terrible experience. But what it taught me, though, in Carolina was truly what was my identity in. And I tell this to recruits when I'm recruiting them, and I always ask them, the first question I ask is, give me the top three most important things in your life in order, 1 to 3. I want to know it. And if they say football first, I'll look at them in front of their parents even, and I'll say, I want you, don't take this wrong. I think that's very shallow, that your identity is in football, because football is going to fail you. And so I start to go, and they're looking at me like, what is this guy talking about? Doesn't he want me to come here?
Yeah.
It's
yeah.
pretty funny, actually.
No, I was just going to say, I mean, you think God works in mysterious ways. And,
yeah.
and you know, even after four Super Bowls and you go to something that doesn't fit in Carolina, you could have thought a lot of people, you know, NFL careers are short, that this was about all there was. And you didn't necessarily know. But you didn't give up, right? Never give up. Yeah, right. And Green Bay turned out to be some of the probably most rewarding experience. I know for Packer fans,
yeah.
it was huge of your life. Yeah. And of course, that's the title of the book. So talk a little bit about the latest book. You've written a few books. This is another one. What makes this one yeah. different?
Yeah, this actually was my favorite one, only because every word in it is written by me. And I was on the phone with my daughter, who works for a marketing firm down in Nashville. And the people that own this company down there wanted me to do a wide receiver book. And I was like, okay, great. I started writing all these things down, and months went by, and I got halfway through the book, and I'm literally on the call because my daughter is in the marketing department and she heads up this project, my book. And I was talking to her, and I said, you know, honey, I said, I'm not going to do the wide receiver book. She says, what, Dad, we're like halfway through. And I said, no, I understand. I said, we're going to put it on the back burner. I said, I really feel God wants me to do a devotional. And she says, well, there's all kinds of devotionals. I said, I know there's all kinds of devotionals. Matter of fact, there's a lot of devotionals for athletes. But how many times have you known that a former professional player wrote a devotional based on their experiences and backed it up with the scripture and the faith that they went through? I said, I'm not sure I've ever seen one. I said, that's what we're going to do. And it literally just came out while I was talking to her on the phone. And sure enough, it took me about 2 weeks to write these 12 devotionals.
Wow.
And they're all life stories, the things that God allowed me to go through, like the Carolina story. And the whole crux of the whole Carolina story, that from a spiritual perspective, that if I would have felt sorry for myself and bitterness would have set in, and I would have been mad at the Carolina Panthers, I probably would have retired.
Yeah.
But I didn't let that win. I let God fight my battles like it talks about in Romans 12. And I just started doing what he calls me to do. And that means be your best and never give up and let him open and close doors. And so I did that. And I started going to practice and enjoying practice. But did my circumstance change? No, it was still horrible. But because I listened, he took me to Green Bay.
Yeah.
And who did we beat in the NFC Championship that yeah. year to go to yeah. the Super Bowl? The Carolina Panthers. Feel good.
Hey, I was going to ask you, because you're a man of great faith and your family, and you grew up with great values. And so, you know, you get hooked up with those early party boys with Jimmy and yeah. Brett, both of them and so forth. So at one time you were the record holder until you got these other guys that played in, you know, 7 or 8, 9 Super Bowls now, and Tom Brady, but yeah. you had the record for, you know, being involved in most Super Bowls. I was going to ask you, yeah. so, you know, you got Brett and you got Jimmy and they're crazy. I mean, in their younger days, they yeah. really were crazy. And so, but you yeah. know, you go to all these different Super Bowls. Is there one town that the Super Bowl that you remember was maybe the best Super Bowl experience? Winning is always, you know, number one. It seems like it, but did you, yeah. you remember those different cities and you remember the experiences? Is there anything that from just the cities that stand out that was kind of interesting?
Yeah, I think, well, first of all, the Bills, I think a lot of the guys partied too much the uh-huh. week of the Super Bowl, especially Tampa.
Yeah.
Tampa was nuts. Those guys were crazy. L.A. was crazy. It was Super Bowl 27. The only one that wasn't crazy was Minnesota because it froze the whole week.
Yes.
Why they had it in Minnesota, I have no idea. But it was awful. Yeah. But here's a funny story, okay, is Jim, we lost the first Super Bowl, and then going into the second Super Bowl, he goes, BB, come here. I said, yeah. He goes, listen. He goes, I know you don't drink. And he goes, I have great respect for that. And that's awesome. He said, however, if we win this Super Bowl, Biebs, me and you are going to go have a beer. And I looked at him and I said, Jim, this is not what I do. And he goes, come on, man, just me and you. I said, I'll tell you what, Jim. If Buffalo Bills win a Super Bowl, me and you privately will go out and have a beer. And so we never won. So we lost four in a row. And so I go to Green Bay. Jim calls Brett. He goes, Brett, whatever you do, don't make BB promise you that you're going to go have a beer with him or you'll never win the Super Bowl. And, he didn't, and he won.
That's good. I mean, because I tell you what, I was around those guys, both of them. I mean, Jimmy's, you know, they had like a beer distributor down in Houston. Those guys were hard to be around, man. I mean, they could put away some brews, buddy. But
really could.
Yeah, no, I tell you what, you've had a great life. You continue to have a great life, and you're such a great inspiration. We want to have you back on again and talk more about you, and we're going to talk more about these books and the landscape that you basically are shaping as a coach and a leader out there for young men. You're a great, great story and a wonderful human being, and I'm just proud to have you on this program with us, buddy. I tell you what, it means a lot.
Well, I appreciate it, guys, but I do know one thing, that if I didn't have a Lord in my life, I would be miserable, and I don't ever want to lose that mindset. Everything good in me is him.
Yeah.
And everything bad in me is me. That's the honest truth.
And we'll have links up at WGN Radio for all of that. And before we let you go, give information about the new book, where people can get it. Maybe if you got some book signings or some ways people can see you get the book, just fill us in.
Yeah, you can get Six Rings kind of anywhere, but the only way you can get Never Give Up, the new book, the devotional book for, and it's really for, it was designed for athletes, but it could apply to anybody in life, but it's through donbeebe.com. That's the only place you can get that book, but you can get Six Rings from nowhere. If you want me to do speaking engagements, so to do a lot of them in the off season, there's a place there too, which I love traveling around doing speaking engagements, just talking about my faith and what the Lord's done for me, or just at a business, inspiring people to never give up. I enjoy it. So I appreciate it, guys. Thanks again, man.
See you, Don.